ॐ भद्रं कर्णे विश्रयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्ये माक्षुभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैः सृष्टवागुं स्वस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नः सार्क्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. Last week I gave the introduction to this Vaitajya Prakarana. We're just starting the second chapter of the Mandukya Upanishad. So I gave an introduction last week. I'm going to start this week on verse 1 of the Vaitajya Prakarana, second chapter. Vaitajyam sarvabhavanam, Vaitajyam sarvabhavanam. Swapna ahur manishinaha, swapna ahur manishinaha, antastanatu bhavanam, antastanatu bhavanam, samvritatvena hetuna, samvritatvena hetuna. A book. Okay. What about you? What do you do? You want a book? Yeah. I think I have one.
Let me just get one.
The Mandukya Upanishad itself, the Upanishad itself is establishing the mityatva of the whole creation, of everything that exists within time and space. The mityatva is here being called Vaitatya. Vaitatya, just for some of you, just to quickly reiterate, mitya or Vaitatya is an order of reality. It's not a thing. It's an order of reality. There's no thing which is called mitya. There is something that enjoys the order of reality that is called mitya. So what mitya means is that thing, that a given thing in and of itself has no being, has no existence at all. It is totally dependent for its being on something else. And yet it's being experienced. So you can't say that it doesn't exist because you're experiencing it. But you also can't say that it exists in its own right. And so the definition of mitya or vaitatya, which is being used here, is sadasad bhyam anirvachaniya, that which can't be categorized as sat, as existing, as real, satyam, as real, or as asat, not there at all. So it's somewhere in this no man's land, in the middle, is mitya. Mitya is also defined as that which depends totally for its being on what we call the adhishtana. Adhishtana is that which gives it being, like the rope is the adhishtana of the snake. If a rope is mistaken for a snake, that snake has no being. It can't exist without the adhishtana, the rope. The rope is what is actually there. Okay. So for mitya, this whole entire creation gains the category of mitya. It gains the order of reality of mitya, not satyam. Satyam means that which actually is in its own right. that which is, that which exists in its own right, that which is self-evident, self-shining, not depending upon a luminary, not depending upon something else to light it up, but which is itself self-evident and self-shining, and not subject to change. All of these things for Satyam. Satyam has what is something that or enjoys the order of reality of actual existence. Is can't be something that comes into existence out of non-existence. That immediately makes it mitya. If something comes into being out of non-being, it has to be mitya, because nothing can come into being out of something that's not there, mm-hmm. something that is zero. And so it must be borrowing being in order for it to come into being. If it's borrowing being, dependent upon being, that makes it mitya. If it has its own being, it's satyam. If it depends upon something else for its being, it's mitya. Now, the whole Mandukya Upanishad is establishing that as the Shruti Pramana, the Upanishads themselves are considered as a pramana, as revealed knowledge. And so the Upanishad, through its teaching methodology and the 12 verses that make up the Mandukya Upanishad, is unfolding the Atma, the self, as being limitless Brahman, that being the Satyam, what is actually here, and the whole creation, waking, dream, and deep sleep state, as mitya, as being totally dependent for its being upon the one Atma, the one self, which is Satyam. That Satyam, as we did in the meditation, that Satyam is conscious being which is not objectifiable. It is the very Atma that is present, both taken to be the waker in the waking state and also illumining the waking world. The one who's taken to be the dreamer in the dream state and who also is the luminosity that the entire dream world enjoys. So that Satchitananda, which is the very nature of my being, which is Brahman, which is limitless, is the Satyam, has for its order of reality that which actually exists, is there in all three periods of time and can never be negated. That me, that very simple self, is the Satyam. And this entire world enjoys and depends upon this simple me, this very simple being that is not objectifiable, but is self-shining. The entire creation depends upon that non-objectifiable self for its being. So all of this is mitya, the self is Satyam. Conscious being is Satyam. Now, the whole Upanishad in the Agama Prakarana of Gaudapada is establishing that as the Shruti Pramana revealed by the Upanishad. Now, the Vaitetya Prakarana is going to establish the Mityatva, the Vaitetya, the dependent nature of this entire creation through logic. Using the Shruti Pramana, it now brings in logic to establish and prove what the Shruti reveals. For something to be, for you to gain really knowledge, what we call nischignanam, firm, rooted knowledge, clarity, there's three things that have to line up for you. One is the Shruti, or I would say more generally the Pramana, the means of knowledge. Any knowledge that you have has to be gained through a valid means of knowledge. It can't just be something coming out of your head. It has to be substantiated by an actual means of knowledge, whether it be sense perception or inference or the Shruti Pramana. You know, you need a means of knowledge there. And that means whatever that means of knowledge gives you as its knowledge needs to be able to withstand logical inquiry. And it needs to be true to your anubhava, your experience. So everything, every knowledge that you have, for it to be knowledge, it needs an accurate pramana, a valid pramana, valid means of knowledge. It needs to withstand logic, logical inquiry, and it needs to be true to your experience. Your experience shouldn't contradict it. Once it's understood, you should be able to see the truth of it, recognize the truth of it experientially, not just as some hypothetical. We're talking about self-knowledge here. You are here. Right? It's not like you're somewhere else. And so it has to match your anubhava. Anubhava means your experience. If it doesn't, then who are we talking about? Self-knowledge, you have to think about it like this too. The Upanishad is an Upanishad, is a means of knowledge for what? For the nature of the self, the nature of reality. But let's say for you, for the nature of you. You are here, not somewhere else. And so therefore the Upanishad has to be a direct means of knowledge, not an indirect means of knowledge, a direct means of knowledge for knowing yourself. How can you have an indirect means of knowledge for knowing yourself when you are here? It doesn't make any sense. In fact, we can say, like say, personally, I've never been to China. And so I have no direct means of knowledge, which would be my sense perception. I've never been to China to really experience it, what it's like there, to go to some of the different cities and experience China. I've never had that. I only have that experience through books and videos, through articles, through things I've read. I have an indirect means of knowledge for whatever knowledge I have of China, because I've never been there. Also, say if I use the Shruti as a pramana for different lokas, different worlds of experience. Mm-hmm. I have no ability. I have an ability to go to China and to experience that with my sense organs, you know. But to be able to say that maybe there's seven higher planes of existence and seven lower planes of existence, for that, that's indirect knowledge that can be given to me by the Vedas, especially the first part of the Vedas. And the reason I would accept that is only because I have Shraddha in the Vedas. Because I can't just hop up to Satyaloka and say, yes, it's really there. For something like that, I have to say, no, the Shastra says it is there. The Vedas say it is there. And because I have Shraddha in the Vedas, I accept that. But I can't have a direct means of knowledge of that. Now, we often will have to have indirect means of knowledge because I've never been there and I don't have the skills or the vibhutis or the siddhis to go there. Now, what about self-knowledge? Knowledge of yourself. Is that going to be indirect? Are you away from yourself? Is there some, this is where we get very confused. Is there some capital S self that is somewhere else that the little small s self has to fly to in some meditative experience? There's nothing wrong with meditation, but do you think that meditation, the meditative experience, is taking you into some inner realm, so you're traveling to some inner realm to meet a self that is other than you. Other than you, the one who is here right now. So if you think that, then who is the one that's here right now? That's the problem. And so with the whole Vedanta, the whole Upanishad, when Upanishad is functioning as a pramana, it is a teaching methodology meant to take you step by step by step to the recognition of your being, not that you aren't already here exactly as you are, who is Brahman, you know, your own self, your own self-identity. You are completely 100% here right now as Brahman, as the infinite being which you are. It is not covered in any way other than by your self-ignorance, which causes you to take your being and identify it with your body, mind, sense organs, with the waker, with the dreamer, with the knower. I identify the conscious me with the knower, you know, the one who's aware of, right? The one who's aware of the world through my sense organs. We don't say that, but I mean, that's what it is. I take myself to be the body, mind, sense, organs complex, who is the knower in relationship to the world. That's what we call, that's this mutual superimposition. That's the problem there. It's not that I'm not here fully. But when I start to have, through the teaching methodology of the Upanishad, when I'm helped to differentiate my own presence from all of the things that I objectify, that I know, including the body, the mind, the sense organs, all of which are objectified, I start to recognize myself in my own right, who I am in and of myself, not who I am in terms of whom I'm not taking myself to be the sense organs which I'm aware of, or the thoughts of the mind which I'm aware of, or the physical body which I'm aware of, but going into the very nature of me, the subject, recognizing the simple truth of my own being, which is not even a knower. Without the mind or sense organs, you're not even a knower. You're just conscious being, self-luminous conscious being, because of which everything is known. And so through all the meditative teaching methodologies and this unfoldment as we're doing right now, this is all the utilization of the Upanishad Pramana, the means of knowledge to help you see yourself. And then as the Upanishad and these teaching methodologies are used, a lot of logic has to come in, because the mind has to see it and understand it. You have to see it, it's the use of the pramana. You have to recognize it, that's the anubhava. It's not what the Upanishad is unfolding is true to your experience. As the unfoldment of an Upanishad takes place, or these prakarana granthas, these explanatory texts, as they take place, you're seeing what the Upanishad is talking about. That's the anubhava. It's not like, oh, what is she talking about? It's taking step by step, pointing to your actual experience. That's the anubhava part. And then it has to hold logically. And so now you have to be able to reason it through. And so now we're going to start reasoning it through. Gaudapada is reasoning it through. Okay. And the first thing he's talking about is the dream, the nature of the dream, because the mityatva, or the vaitatya, of the dream is something taken for granted, So here he says, the vaitatyam sarvabhavanam. The vaitatyam, the apparent nature, or the mityatva, of all things that have come into being, of all objects, we can say, sarva means all bhavas, all experiences, all things that come that exist within duality. So the mityatva of all things, sarva bhavanam, genitive plural, swapne, in the dream, ahuhu, they say, manishinaha. Who says manishinaha? Those wise people who know. Those people who have the vision of the Shastra, the manishinaha, those wise people, ahuhu, they say, what do they say? They say that swapne, in the dream, swapna is swapne when we break the sandhi, that in the dream, all objects, everything, sarva means all bhavas, all experiences that come into being, everything, is vaitatya. There is mityatva, the nature of being mitya, for all things that exist in the dream. And everybody will just say, yeah. Right? Swapna is what we call a drishtanta. Every logical syllogism must have a drishtanta. It must have an illustration which you will agree with. You know? If I were to say, for instance, what if I were to say, this world is mitya. This whole universe is mitya. Then you have to say, the whole universe is false in that it's false in that it depends upon something else for its being. It doesn't have an independent reality. It's mitya. Then you have to say, like what? What's a drishtanta for that? Are you just making this up? Is there any type of illustration that you can give? Any type of example? I need an example. Then the manishinaha will say, like in the dream. All experiences here in this waking state are vaitatya. But here, he's not saying that. All they're saying right now is the manishinaha, the wise people, they ahuhu, they say that in the dream, all objects of experience are mitya. Everything. The whole dream, everything that exists in the dream is mitya. And then he gives a reason. He gives two reasons. Antastanat bhavanam, because all of the objects, all of the bhavas, all of the experiences that you're having are inside. They're existing inside the body, right? Or inside the nervous, the nadis in the body. All the experiences, this is their logic, all experiences that you have in the dream, they're existing inside the body. And then you say, well, so what? They're existing inside the body. The Purvapakshi will come in and say, you're saying that something existing inside something else makes it mithya? What about this cup existing inside this room? That doesn't make it mithya. There's nothing wrong. There's nothing. That doesn't negate anything. If something exists inside something else, that doesn't negate anything. Right? This cup exists inside the room. That doesn't mean anything. So he gives another reason. Samvrtatvena hetuna. No. It's not just that they exist inside. The space for them is too small. The space in this body, and in the body, and Shankara will say, and in the nadis, in the nerves, you know, where the dream, they say the dream takes place. Or you could say in the body or in the nadis. There's not enough room. There's not enough room in your body to have a dream. You know, when it's all those people. And they use an example later, like Shankara uses an example. What does he say here? He says, you know, I mean like elephants and mountains. Elephants, mountains, people. These things, you know, they're too big. They're too big to exist in the dream. And so then the objector, so these are the two reasons he gives. First he gives, well, it's mithya because they're existing inside the body. And then he says, just to make clear for the next objector, and they're existing inside the body, and not only that, there's no room in there for the dream. Okay? And so now the objection can come. The objector can come and say, we're not saying that it exists inside the body. We're not stupid. Of course there's no room in there. You know? So we think that the dream is another sthana. It exists outside, somewhere, in a subtle room. It's outside. It's not inside the body. It's outside. Okay? So that's the next objection. So let's look at that verse 2. He says, Adirga tva chikalasya gatva darshana pashyati gatva deshana pashyati pratibuddhascha vai sarvaha tasmin deshena vidyate adirga tva chikalasya gatva deshan napashyati prati buddha cha vai sarvaha tasmin deshe navidyate. You say no. Why? Adirgat tvacha kalasya, because there's not enough time. There's not a length of time. Dirga means long time. There's not enough time. Adirga means there's not a lot. It's not long. Because of there not being a long time. There's not enough. Because of there not being a long enough time. Adirga tvacha kalasya. That's what he means. Gatva deshan napushyati. When the dream takes place, there isn't enough time for going to the places. Gatva deshan. For going to the places, right? So having gone to the places, having reached the place, you know, napashyati, it's not possible to see. Having gone to a place, you have to travel. You have to travel to these places and then see, right? But there's not enough time for that. There's not enough time in a dream for you to travel. Say you're going to some place, Shankara's Bhasha. It takes a month to reach there, right? It takes a whole month to get there. You can't reach there, you know. Go to all of these places and see. You can't do it because there's not enough time. And not only that, he says, it's not only enough time in the dream. He says, prati buddhaha cha vai sarvaha. And he says pratibuddha means when somebody is awake. Sarvaha pratibuddha cha. And everyone who wakes up, vai indeed, as is well known, everybody who has awakened, pratibuddha cha sarvaha, tasmin deshe na vidyate, they're not in that place where they dream. So the idea is, if you're dreaming, say like last night I had a dream and I was at the Coimbatore temple in India. So it's a beautiful dream. So that means that I've just traveled for 33 hours on Singapore Airlines. So 33 hours, you know. And then I had to spend 2 hours being picked up and get there to the ashram and then make my way to the temple, right? And so now that I'm there at the temple and the alarm goes off and I wake up, right? But when I wake up, I'm not at the temple. Right? I'm not there. So if I had really gone there, when I would wake up, I would be there, right? And then in the commentary, he says, Shankara says also, and Swamiji reiterates this in his commentary on this, if I was there at the temple and I met some friends there, you know, we were talking and discussing, then those friends would be able to say to me, oh, I saw you at the temple this morning. It was nice to see you at the temple. But nobody can say that. Nobody will say that they saw me there. And when I wake up, anyway, I'm still here. So there's really no possibility, you know, of the dream that I experience actually existing in this plane of reality. That dream is taking place, you know, on another plane of reality. It's mitya, it's a subjective plane of reality, not this physical plane of reality. He's just saying these things as though it's something that we don't know. But we're just breaking it down. You'll see as we go through, it's almost like breaking down the obvious. But what I would suggest is that even though our mind is going to go like that, just follow him, just follow his logic and enjoy it, you know. Because what he's doing is in a very terse way, as we start going through, just establishing the mityatva of the dream, you end up being able to establish the mityatva of the waking state. So that's where he's going. So it's very interesting. So let's do another verse here. Abhavascha ritadinam. Abhavascha ritadinam. Shruyate nyaya purvakam. Shruyate nyaya purvakam. Vaitatyam tena vai praptam. Vaitatyam tena vai praptam. Swapna ahu prakashitam. Swapna ahu prakashitam. Abhavaha cha ratadinam. Shruyate nyaya purvakam. Vaitatyam tena vai praptam. Swapne ahu prakashitam. He's giving an example from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Abhavaha cha ratadinam. This is a section from the Brihadaranyaka where the self-effulgence of the Atma in the dream state is being discussed. But in the discussion of that revealing the self-evident, the self-effulgent nature of consciousness in the dream, which is the kind of top part, it's what's being discussed in this Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, he refers to the dream and establishes...
Outside. Open the door.
Yeah,
open the door. Open the door. Whoa. Just throw him off the cliff there.
How did that happen?
No, let him out.
No, slam the door.
I know, Edward.
Did you leave?
Thanks. Falling into my pants.
Wow. Luckily he liked you.
He did. He's been going up to your bag the whole class.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so it's biting in my toe. And then it just ran away. When I was moving there.
But did you see him go now?
The door's open. Is he definitely gone, Hassel?
Yeah, yeah, no.
Okay.
Good, yay. Thank you. He's free. That's the grace of the Upanishad saved.
saved the mouse.
Yeah, moksha, well. Liberation for the little mouse. Okay.
Timmy might wait on the end of her steps.
That's true. Yeah.
Okay, now I can focus.
I didn't know any of that was going on. Thanks. All right.
We did.
Yeah, we did.
Oh, I did.
We were letting it slide until something happened.
Okay.
Okay, now we can get real.
That's why you guys were always laughing back and forth.
Yes.
Yeah. That's why Amit and I were sitting with our feet like this.
Oblivious. Over here, we're oblivious.
Yeah.
I was oblivious.
Were you? Yeah.
And you, there was something going on.
Yeah.
You know, you all just haven't lived with mice for long enough. For me, I don't have any of those feelings at all. Nothing. But it's only from being with them for so long. As long as Tibby's been here. She's a wonderful little huntress.
She catches.
Did you pick him up, actually?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Good for the mouse.
Okay, so this is
okay, here we go. So in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, establishing the self-evident nature, the self-luminous nature of the Atma, and that is the really light, that the self is the light that illumines that dream. If you think about it, what is the luminary of the dream? It's the jyoti, it's the self-luminosity of the self. And so this section of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad establishes that in a really beautiful way. But in the process of doing that, they start talking about the nature, the mithya nature of the dream. For instance, they'll say, this abhavaha cha ratadinam, a rata is a chariot. So they say, in the dream, there's no chariots, there's no elephants, and they have a list of all of these things that are not really there in the dream, that are appearing in the dream. There's not some real chariot. He says, abhava, there are not chariots in the dream. You're dreaming of chariots, but you cannot say that there's a real chariot there and there's a real elephant there. You know, so he goes through a list of all of the things that are not really there, that are being experienced in the dream. So what he says here is that, so now in this Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, he says, abhavaha cha ratadinam, and there is no existence, and that there is no existence, abhava, of chariots, etc. Shruyate, this abhava, is said in the Shruti, in the Brihadaranyaka. Shruyate means it is heard. When we say it is heard, it means that the Upanishad is telling us this. The Upanishad is a revealed means of knowledge that comes to you through your ears. So when we talk about what the Upanishad has to say, it's what is being heard by you. So it's heard that the Shruti says. Another way, when it says Shruyate, which literally means it is heard, we would say that the Shruti says. See what I mean? But it is heard by you because it's revealed knowledge that is being passed down. So this non-existence of chariots, etc., the Shruti tells us, Nyaya Purvakam, along with logic. It just doesn't say that there's, you know, it's talking about the dream and establishing the mithyatva of the dream. So in this unfoldment of the Shruti, it's unfolding it together with logic. And so doing that, then what happens? The vaitatyam tena vai praptam. The vaitatyam is gained, the mithyatva is gained, is understood by that logic. And so he says, swapne ahuhu prakashitam. The Shruti, these manishinaha, these wise people, they tell us this, they reveal, this is something revealed in reference to the dream. Prakashitam means revealed. It is revealed in the dream. What is revealed? The mithyatva of the dream. The mithyatva is revealed in the dream. by this logic that the Shruti is using, explaining that there's no existence for Ratha, etc., for chariot, etc. Why this is important here, why Gaudapada brings this in here, is because we have to see that the Shruti itself is establishing not just saying things, but also establishing what it says through logic, which the Shruti does. And he's just bringing this statement in here to say that I'm giving you logic now of how the dream is, that the dream is mithya. The Shruti itself gives this logic. It's not just coming from me. The Shruti itself is using this logic. And so here he says, just a minute. Okay, there's nothing in there that's particularly important. Okay, we have to stop here because the next one is the beginning of another segment, so I want to stop and work on that one with the verses that follow. Okay. Let's make a moment.
Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Hari Om.
Inspire me one more time that the Nitya form of the dream is very obvious, but is it supposed to be an illustration to show how the waking state can be?
In the next verse, which I didn't get to today, I didn't really expect to make it there today anyway, but it will actually break down a logical syllogism step by step by step and show how each one of these, how the syllogism is developed, you know, and with the different parts of it. So you just wait until next week.
Okay, yeah. Because I'll wait till next week, but it almost seems a little silly, kind of, for me.
Well, I would say more like this. We so take the dream for granted, the mityatva of the dream for granted, but we don't... we're not able to relate that incredible phenomena of having a dream. What we actually experience in the dream, we're actually living in a different, totally different space. And when we're in that different space, that dream space, it's completely real to us until you wake up, right? We tend not to understand that, how that can be an example. We should be able to have that dream and say, you know, why isn't this a dream? If that can be a dream, when I'm in that dream, it's so real, how do I know that in this waking state, I'm not in some sort of a dream? Mm-hmm. You know, we can say that the dream state is subjective. Yes, it's subjective. Subjective from the standpoint of the waking state. It's not subjective from the standpoint of the dream character within the dream state. It's subjective from us here. So... many of you probably did have that thought at one time or another, you know? Like, how do I know? Because when I'm in the dream state, I don't know that that's a subjective experience. I don't know that from the standpoint of the dream character. So how do I know that this has any, you know, greater reality than the dream? Then you could say, well, you know, from this standpoint, this reality lasts longer. The dream is subjective and taking place, you know, subjectively and taking place within this reality, in a sense. But then you'll say, Well, how do I know that I'm not part of somebody else's dream? Right? Just like the characters in my dream, all of those characters in my dream are part of me, my dream. I'm the Ishwara of that dream.
Mm-hmm.
Right? How do I know that I am not part of somebody else's dream, that Ishwara? So, I mean, mumukshus tend to have these kind of thoughts. Other people don't bother.
Science fiction writers.
Science fiction writers, yeah, exactly. But it's kind of it's logical, you know? And so we're going to go look at a logical syllogism, which says, you know, there is a phenomena that's common between the waking state and the dream state, in that in both states, the world that is being experienced is drishya, it's objectifiable. In the waking state and in the dream state, that's the same in that way. What is different that for us is that in this waking state, we, as compared to the dream, this existing inside, my body is not there, you know, and being too small of a space is not there.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something that is there in both, and that's that both are objectifiable. Mm-hmm. And so we have to see what that means. That's a huge thing that we've not usually think about, the repercussions of something that is objectified. It means that it is illumined by a subject. Right? If something is illumined, then it's not self-luminous. So we have to see, we have to analyze what all of that means, which is what he's going to start doing now.
Is the chariot an example of that? Is that what the significance of that is?
What the significance of that is that the chariot, there's several verses in this section in the Brihadaranyaka, but they're talking about that, say, in a dream where there's elephants and chariots and some other things they list in this dream. They're talking about, in fact, there's no chariot there and there's no elephant there. But all of those are mithya. They don't really exist in the dream as real objects. The reason for this subject matter is really all about, in the Brihadaranyaka, is all about looking at what is really the luminosity or the source, the what is lighting up the self as being the luminary of the dream. But in this unfoldment, they're talking about the mityatva of the objects in the dream. And so he's just wants you to know that the Shruti itself talks about and gives certain logic to why the objects in the dream are not real. That's the point of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like if you're writing a dissertation or something, or you're writing a book, you're making a statement, and then you want to bring in an authority, and you quote an authority to back up what you're saying. So Gaudapada is quoting an authority. He's saying the Upanishads themselves talk about this together with logic. Mm-hmm. Because it's important. And it is important, as we'll see. Because it's an extraordinary drishtanta. The dream, sometimes Swamiji would call it the Achilles heel of the reality of the creation. The Achilles heel, you know, it's that weak spot. That kind of makes you, it gives you a glimpse.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you a glimpse of the possible mityatva of the creation. And then when you really start looking at it logically, you know, you really can't say that the waking state is any less mitya than the dream state as we start working through all of this. But you can't establish it as having any less mitya, mityatva than the dream state.
So where,
and you have this drishtanta for your mind to make this leap to really understand. Having a real drishtanta, a real example that's a real life example, is so powerful.
Yeah.
You know? And just to be able to recognize, like in what we do in this waking state, some of the guided meditations and just the teaching methodology, we continue to objectify, to help you to objectify all of the things that you had taken to be the self. You know, once, if like now I take this to be the self and I'm aware of all of you, I'm the subject, you're all the object. So you're all objectified. Okay? That's what we mean by objectified. All of you are the object, I'm the subject. But then I realized that the same five sense organs that are objectifying you are objectifying the physical body. In fact, without my five sense organs, not only could I not know you, I couldn't know this body. You just remove, sometimes Swamiji, when he was really doing it in thoroughly, we would remove one sense organ at a time. Okay, remove your sense of hearing. And then I can't hear this either. Remove your sense of touch, just go one by one. And everything is negated, including the physical body. You know, and then, so now the body becomes, you realize that the body is objectified. Not just this, this is objectified. And then you go next to the sense organs. The sense organs, because of which this is objectified, themselves are objectified. Because your mind is aware of your sense organs. They know if the sense organs are working or not working, if your ears are deaf or losing their hearing, or your eyes have 20/20 vision, or they're fading or blind. If your sense of touch is functioning, your sense of taste, if you've lost your sense of taste, your sense of smell, you're very aware of it. You're aware of the functioning of your sense organs by your mind. And also your mind needs to use the sense organs as instruments. Right? If they're not using the sense organs just off daydreaming, the sense organs are here, but they're not functioning. The sense organs are also objectifiable. We don't usually do this. Mm-hmm. We objectify from the skin out. Mm-hmm. But now the body gets thrown into the mix of objects and the sense organs. And then the thoughts. Are you aware of your thoughts? Do you know what you're thinking? Can you tell me, what did you just think? Oh, I just thought blah, blah, blah. How do you know that? Well, because I'm aware of my thoughts. In fact, I can sit and just quietly, in meditation, just watch my thoughts. You know? The thoughts are objectified. There's only one thing that's not objectified, and that is consciousness. Your memories are objectified. The I thought, the I am, is objectified. These are all experiences that are objectified. Just like in the dream, it's easier for you, if you look at the dream, oh, I had this dream last night, and every single part of that dream is part of the dream. The bodies, the mind, the sense organs, all the experiences, they're all part of the warp and woof and fabric of the dream. And the whole dream takes place and is illumined, this Jyotishwa, you know, this Swayam Jyotish, mm-hmm. It's illumined by the Atma. Everything. Not only the dream landscape, the all the dream characters, the character you're identified with, the dream animals, everything that makes up the dream is illumined by one self, which is you. And you are not illumined, you're self-luminous. You're self-luminous, and the one because of whom the whole dream is illumined. It's the same here, so exactly what you know to be true in the dream, we can logically take you step by step by step to realize that it's exactly the same here. That the everything that you had taken to be you is part of the warp and woof of the dream, the dreamscape. Right? It's part of the warp and woof of this physical creation, this we call Ishwar. So then you'll see, just as it is in the dream, so it is here. Even though, from the standpoint of the waker, the dream is subjective, right? But from the standpoint, if I take the dream here and look at it, and the waking state, or the waking state here and the dream here, from the standpoint of each other in reference to the Atma, there's no difference. You can say this is little mitya, this is big mitya. You know? Little mitya and big mitya, both are mitya. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's such a surprise to see your mind as an object or your body as an object. I mean,
because it's not usually thought of. When it's taught, though, it's a no-brainer. This is why you bring in that pramana so that you can see it. It's logical and it's experiential. You can't say, no, I'm not aware of my body. You can't say, oh no, the sense organs aren't aware of the body. You can't do it, because they are. You can't say that your mind is not known, because it is known. You can't say there's not a subject object, because there is. You know? That's the anubhava. The logic the logic and the experience are very intertwined. That's why this teaching works, why the pramana works, is because every step of the way you can't say no, because you clearly see it. See what I mean? If you clearly see it, then you can say, yeah, well, what about this? But then there's another, the pramana keeps going. It doesn't stop. It expects you to say, what about this? And that's the next thing it talks about. And all the while, you're seeing it. That's how the Upanishad works. That's what the Upanishad is. It's a pramana. Pramana means a means of knowledge.
I notice the word mithya is not used in the verses itself.
Vaitatya. It's used like a synonym.
Yeah.
So did you say that the knowledge becomes firm through the ceasings of the pramana?
For knowledge to take place, for direct knowledge, yeah. Yeah, shruti, which is the pramana.
The logic and the own experience.
And the yukti and anubhava.
Okay.
The pramana. If you we're using the shruti pramana here. But pramana is any means of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the pramana, we're saying shruti, yukti, logic, and anubhava experience. These all have to line up. Yeah.
With the little mouse in the room, too.
Carol, there's something different about, as far as I can tell, when I try to objectify my mind, that it's different because it always seems to be that it's the mind looking at the mind. You know, objectifying a lamp or even the body.
You think it's the mind looking at the mind.
Uh-huh.
There's a way that you might be thinking like about that like this. Like say, for instance, you have a thought, and then you have a thought that says, I'm having a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you have a thought, I'm mm-hmm. having a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have another thing, I like the thought. Don't think of it like this. This is a thought, the thought. The I'm having a thought is a thought. I like the thought, that is a thought.
Mm-hmm.
All of them are just thoughts. They may be interrelated with each other, that's fine, but they're still just thoughts. All three of those thoughts are known. All three of those thoughts are shining. You are aware of all three of the thoughts. One thought comes, it is known, and it goes. Next thought comes, it is known, and it goes. Next thought comes, it is known, and it goes. The knownness is always the same. I am the knower of the thoughts. I don't go. I consider myself the knower of the thoughts, but the thought goes, I don't go.
As far as I can tell, when I look at things,
yeah.
I mean, it's almost a Yogacara-like thing, and they've had too much of that kind of influence, but it's like, I know the thoughts are thoughts afterwards. I can look back in time and say, oh, that was a thought. But while they're happening, it's like I'm caught up with them and identified with them in a certain way.
Well, I think that this is why, if that's the case, one of the things that's very helpful for that is japa. Because what japa does is it breaks the associative thinking to give you a chance to differentiate the consciousness, you know, that's illumining the thoughts. By the repetition of a mantra, normally your one thought generates the next, just automatically by associative thinking. And so you're just long gone. The mind is just going on. It's taking care of itself with associative thinking. Are you with me on that? Associative thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if I bring in a mantra like Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, and then I stop. Say I do it 10, 20 times with very little space in between, and then I stop just by an act of will. Now the mind doesn't know what to do. Because the associative thinking has been focused on only one mantra. And so when you stop it, all of a sudden there's quiet. It kind of turns you off. Says a life of its own. Okay. So when you stop the mantra, then the mind just doesn't quite know what to do, so it has a moment of silence. And so you try this again, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, stop again. And then what you do after you've done that a few times and given the mind a chance to absorb into that silence, then you do Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. And now you're starting to see mantra silence, mantra silence, mantra silence. And then as you keep doing that, what will happen is there's a shift that takes place in your the vision of the experience. And that is you start seeing, instead of mantra silence, you start seeing that the mantra is taking place in silence, the silence of your own being. And then you get used to recognizing your presence in relationship to the thoughts. Because remember, a mantra, it's religious. Like if I say Om Namah Shivaya, I'm evoking Shiva. It's giving me a certain bhav, a certain religious or spiritual attitude when I'm doing it, which is a nice thing. It's that itself is kind of absorbing, but it's still only a thought. Like if I'm saying Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, that's chain thinking, as like it, right? Because you have one thought leads to the next, leads to the next, leads to the next. It's just I'm changing that only by putting in one thought. Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. And when you first start that, all you're doing is hearing this Om Namah Shivaya. That's all that's happening for you. But if we practice the japa, you know, and get those spaces in between, and then that will lead to the dual recognition of the silent presence of yourself and the mantra rising and setting in it. Then you'll know. So maybe we have to do some japa. It'd be fun for us to do japa during doing some of the meditations. Do it together. You can just start doing it together, you know, orally, and then you do it just very silent, almost at a whisper level, and then you just do it mentally. I can guide you on that. You can do it. It's very absorbing, but you'll see what I mean. You're not used to making that. We need to put the mind into a condition where that viveka occurs naturally. And then it's something that you can notice easily all the time. That's why japa is amazing. Stood the test of time. You know, everybody's telling beads, all of the different religions have. They've lost what.
Did you personally use it a lot, or is it more of an just?
I have used it a lot, but I learned it. I learned what it is. It delivers the goods, you know. Mm-hmm. And it makes you recognize your own being so profoundly. And then you can keep doing that until it's just natural. So that recognition is that you're at home with it. You're at home with recognizing in every thought the adhishtana. You know, the adhishtana of every thought means the very sat-chit conscious being which that thought depends upon for its knownness, for its very life. And you've differentiated it, so I am always present and these thoughts are coming and going in me. That's the truth anyway. But the mind hasn't always recognized it, so we use that japa to make that viveka, that discrimination. So very powerful and very, very helpful. Maybe we'll do that next week.